Welcome to the Kelly Patrick Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. In today's episode, I am joined by Jorge Besada to discuss many of the hot button topics going on in the world in 2026. We, of course, dive into some of the Zionist, Jew-Gentile fallacies that we have described in previous episodes. We jump into some Holocaust history topics that are, of course, very controversial. As always, I appreciate Jorge for joining me. If you're a fan of the Kelly Patrick Show, thank you so much for tuning in. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to the Kelly Patrick Show. Thank you so much for tuning in. In today's episode, I am joined by Jorge Besada. As I say every time I intro Jorge here on the Kelly Patrick Show, he's one of my favorite when it comes to articulating the Austrian economics, libertarian messaging surrounding so many very important topics. In today's episode, we are going to dive into one of the more maybe controversial, you could say, off-limits types of topics. But I've gotten such great feedback from some of the people I know on a personal level related to these Jorge Besada episodes. So I love it. Jorge's got some slides prepared. Jorge, where do we take this?
Hey, thanks, Kelly, again for that, you know, really nice intro. And again, you know, I got Ludwig von Mises here. The Austrians, those are really the foundation of everything we're doing here. And hopefully we're getting closer and closer to more people, you know, really uniting behind these men. So this is our favorite topic. You know, we seem to be talking a lot about Jew-Gentile conflicts. It's just a big mess. So I've titled this little like discussion, Jew-Gentile Fallacies and Ramifications, Anti-Semitism, World War II, Zionism, and the Holocaust. One of the things I'll be mentioning a little later is that Murray Rothbard, who is like Mr. Libertarian, was a Holocaust denier. He thought that the whole gas chamber stuff was a mythology. So, I mean, that's huge. We'll get to that in a second. You know, so as I always like to say, you know, these men, the Austrian School of Economics, they were like Galileo, Bruno, and Copernicus were way ahead of their time by letting us know that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe. So the Austrians are the foundation for everything. Those are the men that explain how the economy works. They're the ones that predicted that socialism was going to be a failure. And they also explained how society evolved, how we went from like little tribes to this massive complex society that we have now. And their insights relate to history, to all of these conflicts. So, you know, we always have to start by talking a little bit about them. And So moving on here. Now, a myth is a popularly held but false belief or idea. You know, that's what a myth is. And we can say that socialism was a flawed mythology that led to a flawed state, right? The Soviet Union. And it ended up making the poverty and the social injustices that they wanted to solve, it actually made them worse, right? And a lot of smart people fell into this disaster. Now, from my perspective, and it's becoming increasingly obvious, you know, to a lot of people, Zionism is also a mythology that led to the failed state of Israel, and it intensified the very anti-Semitism that it was, you know, that supposedly it was going to fix. Now, socialism, we already solved it. We had to deal with 70 years of suffering in the Soviet Union, the Chinese disaster, and my own native Cuba is still going on with it, but at least after all this suffering and great books and all that stuff, it was sort of overcome. Now, Zionism is an even deadlier ideology because not only has it given us all kinds of chaos, but it's still growing it's controlling more and more of the planet, leading to more wars, more chaos. And as I will show here quickly, I mean, Zionism, had there been no Zionism, there wouldn't have been a Second World War, there wouldn't have been the Middle East chaos that we have, there wouldn't have been the chaos that we have in Europe with all this Muslim migration, what it's doing over there, you know, culturally, and also Zionism has bankrupted the United States, right? We're blowing $1.5 trillion in wealth every year in military spending. A lot of people say, oh, we're giving Israel $10 billion a year. That's nothing. We're spending $1.5 trillion every year because we are the ones that are destroying, you know, all of the Middle East countries and all that stuff. So it's really bankrupting the country and it's destroying freedom of speech here in the United States. We just saw how Thomas Massey, you know, he got run out and replaced by a totally clueless person. So the good thing is that all this chaos is getting more and more people to pay attention to what is going on. So we have no choice but to deal with this as best as we can. So with that in mind, seeing socialism as a bad ideology that lured lots of bright people into total disaster, Zionism is the same way. So we got to read this great quote from Friedrich Hayek. most people are still unwilling to face the most alarming lesson of modern history, that the greatest crimes of our time have been committed by governments that had the enthusiastic support of millions of people who were guided by moral impulses. It is simply not true that Hitler or Mussolini, Lenin or Stalin appealed only to the worst instincts of their people. They also appeal to some of the feelings which also dominate contemporary democracies. Right now, a lot of people are like, oh, you don't go along with Netanyahu, you're an anti-Semite, you're pro-Hamas. You know, this moral pontification, we're seeing it happening again. And now, very quickly, Zionism was destined to fail because anti-Semitism is just a set of fallacies, and you can only overcome fallacies through reason, logic, and education. Asking Jews to leave Europe to create themselves a country somewhere else and call people anti-Semites, pass Holocaust denial laws, and hate speech laws, that does nothing to overcome the fallacies. It can only exacerbate them. So from the very beginning, it was an ideology that was bound to fail, and it led to 120 years of chaos, as I will briefly show. So it's very important. I got another great Mises quote here that I have to read. Mises tells us, "The problems involved are purely intellectual and must be dealt with as such via reason, logic, education. It is disastrous to shift them to the moral sphere and to dispose of supporters of opposite ideologies by calling them villains. The rigid dogmatism peculiar to religious groups and to Marxism results only in irreconcilable conflict. It condemns beforehand all dissenters as evildoers. It calls into question their good faith. It asks them to surrender unconditionally. No social cooperation is possible where such an attitude prevails." No better is the propensity, very popular nowadays, to brand supporters of other ideologies as lunatics. So again, we're not going to solve our problems, whether it's socialism or Jew-Gentile chaos, by calling people stupid or crazy, right? Okay, so now, one more very important quote from Mises. "History speaks only to those people who know how to interpret it on the grounds of the correct theories." And that is why we're not going to do it live here, but we're going to add a 15-minute introduction to Austrian economics that will provide the foundation for the rest of what we're going to be talking about. But before that, I do want to briefly mention the First World War. I wrote an article for the Mises Institute, Relearning the Lessons We Never Learned from World War I. In the First World War, we have yet another great example of how lots of people, the experts, the theologians, the politicians, with the best of intentions, they fooled themselves into coercing their populations and their youth to run across the trenches for 4 years for reasons not one out of a million people today know or care about. Right? We have to be open to the possibility that we're doing the exact same thing. The Germans in World War I, today everybody knows they went out there to conquer the world. Every historian today knows that the First World War I was just a clusterfuck of tribalism and stupidity. The Germans weren't chopping off the hands of Belgian babies or none of that nonsense. So it's the more examples we have where we can see humanity fall for all kinds of stupid nonsense, we can realize, well, maybe we're doing the same thing now.
An introduction to the vital ideas of the so-called Austrian School of Economics and men like founder Karl Menger, Ludwig von Mises, and 1974 Nobel laureate in economics F.A. Hayek, who happens to be Elon Musk's and Mick Jagger's favorite economist.
As a disciple of Friedrich von Hayek,
the socio-economic insights provided by the Austrians and its leading intellectuals like Karl Menger, Ludwig von Mises, and especially F.A. Hayek, are still so ridiculously far ahead of our time and mainstream intellectuals, that even today's leading thinkers like renowned popular science writer Matt Ridley, by their own admission, are still catching up with him. Ridley humbly acknowledges this in a 2011 speech where he mentions,
Somebody who came to Friedrich von Hayek comparatively late in life, I'm still catching up with him.
Fortunately, their ideas are spreading. On November 19, 2023, Javier Milei won the presidency of Argentina, thus becoming the first world leader whose economic views are grounded on the Austrians.
Hayek! If you care about your fucking country, I'll read Ludwig von Mises.
It is vitally important to always keep in mind the seemingly obvious fact that whether a fellow Homo sapiens grows up to be a socialist, capitalist, Zionist, Jew, Christian, Muslim, Russian, American or whatever, it all comes down to the ideas, software and circumstances which lead it to act, and we must thus focus on the evolution of such ideas, software and avoid simplistic evil or mad analysis, or seek to blame people when complex evolutionary factors are the root causes of conflicts. As Ludwig von Mises tells us, it is ideas that group men into fighting factions, that press the weapons into their hands, and that determine against whom and for whom the weapons shall be used. It is they alone, and not arms, that, in the last analysis, turn the scales. Mises again. Neither as judges allotting praise and blame nor as avengers seeking out the guilty should we face the past. We seek truth, not guilt. We want to know how things came about to understand them, not to issue condemnations. Until the late 1700s, most people lived in small, nearly self-sufficient farming towns. As technology improved, engines and factories, the rate at which mankind could transform raw materials into wealth was rapidly increasing in cities. A growing class of businessmen, entrepreneurs, capitalists were constantly innovating, and due to people's freedom to trade their private property only for things they deemed superior alternatives, entrepreneurs also had to copy the innovations of competitors, thus inadvertently creating and spreading superior information, turning cities and eventually the entire planet into supercomputers that were constantly reordering mankind in increasingly productive and technologically advanced states. Competition between increasingly wealthy productive factories entrepreneurs motivated them to pay increasing amounts of wealth for labor relative to what people could earn in farms, causing people to move to cities quickly leading to massively complex metropolises supercomputers. These changes, in other words, what we could refer to as the evolution of capitalism, were not the deliberate design of people, they were, as Karl Menger writes, the unintended results of historical development, or in the words of Adam Ferguson, indeed the result of human action, but not the execution of any human design. Just like cells over millions of years inadvertently, via a non-designed evolutionary process created the respiratory, nervous, digestive, etc., systems that led them to cooperate to create multicellular organisms, so has an evolutionary process, not our reason, created the so-called free market, capitalism, or what Menger and Herbert Spencer cleverly referred to as the social organism. Morals are ways of acting, they too are information which also emerges and spreads via economic competition to considerable degrees. It is hard-working, tolerant, courteous people workers, who treat everyone with respect regardless of age, sex, race, religion, etc., in a manner that maximizes cooperation, production and thus competitiveness, who thanks to competition, inadvertently motivate everyone in our role as workers to be likewise. As Hayek writes, competition is, after all, always a process in which a small number makes it necessary for larger numbers to do what they do not like, be it to work harder, to change habits, or to devote a degree of attention, continuous application, or regularity to their work which without competition would not be needed. As millions of Italians, Britons, Germans, Jews and others from all over the world came to America, it was ultimately the competition which grows from private property and thus individual liberty which stripped these people of their otherwise nationalistic, ethnocentric, tribalistic identities and evolved what came to be seen as the classic American character of wanting to be seen as a reputable and honest businessman or professional, who treats everyone with respect and wears a business suit as opposed to older ethnocentric attires. The role of governments and thus coercion should be minimized because governmental or public sector bureaucracies, being coercive monopolies which get their life or order sustaining wealth through taxes and compulsion, are immune to the competitive information spreading incentives which motivate private sector entrepreneurs and companies to keep up with the competition in terms of information and hustle. Government competition immune plans, projects, and regulations which are just competition immune coerced information, can't work if people are free to not fund them via taxation, or act differently than mandated via regulations, so they inevitably require massive compulsion, and potentially making criminals out of millions who have harmed no one and just prefer to do things differently. As Hayek reminds us, the argument for liberty is not an argument against organization, which is one of the most powerful tools human reason can employ, but an argument against all exclusive, privileged, monopolistic organization, against the use of coercion to prevent others from doing better. This classic nighttime image helps explain the difference between competitive private free orders, South Korea, and monopolistic competition immune government coerced orders, North Korea. Compare the increasingly regulated and thus paralyzed healthcare sector, which has grown from consuming less than 5% of the economic pie in 1960, to over 20% today, culminating in the spectacular government-forced COVID mania tyranny, to the free competitive information technology sector where even the poorest of Americans can afford rapidly improving amazing cell phones and technology. What a person must learn in order to legally offer medical advice via the licensing of doctors, where he must learn it via the licensing of medical schools, and countless other gigantic bodies of knowledge information are dictated by monopolistic competition-less bureaucracies like the American Medical Association, the Food and Drug Administration, and numerous others. By comparison, the information technology sector has very few paralyzing competition-immune government regulations, so competition motivates the creation and spread of superior information at breakneck speed, and is obviously transforming our world right before our eyes. Thus, freedom and emerging competitive knowledge discovery, as opposed to leading to chaos, is what 1. Enables and motivates the discovery and spread of superior information and subsequent social order, 2. Civilizes us, 3. Protects us from being coerced into doing something we don't want and thus allows us to live our lives as we wish, 4. And is vital for discovering the truth. Freedom is the ultimate algorithm. not having the slightest clue how civilization, capitalism, and the bewildering complexity of modern cities emerges from private property and freedom, since this amazing mechanism's order had been designed, not by clever men, but by an evolutionary process we didn't even understand at the time, Homo sapiens understandably fell for all the usual anti-capitalist fallacies. Just like environmental factors favor the emergence and spread of certain genes, the growing complexity of the social order and Homo sapiens' ignorance of its evolution workings economics led to an environment that was ripe for the emergence of a new ideology mythology. Socialism, communism, scientism, coercive competition, immune monopoly, central planning by experts who would allegedly create a more efficient and fairer society compared to the seemingly unjust chaos freedom emerging capitalism was creating. Eventually someone would describe these increasingly popular myths in a manner that was bound to go viral, and that is what sort of happened with Karl Marx and his bite-sized communist manifesto where he writes. The theory of the communists may be summed up in the single sentence, abolition of private property. Abolition of the family. Via Lenin's Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, 1918, by destroying private control of wealth and putting it in the hands of a single competition-immune coercive bureaucracy of experts, government, socialism inadvertently destroyed the competitive knowledge discovery that only existed among competing entrepreneurs in the private sector, and also the businessman's profit-loss calculations which kept the private sector ordered in a manner where more wealth was produced, sales revenue, than consumed, costs, thus being profitable pie wealth life order increasing. This led to technological stagnation, more consumption than production leading to massive famines, and tyranny as the public had to be coerced into following the government expert plans. Kulaks, small slightly better off Russian farmers businessmen, who would profit by paying laborers less than 100% of the revenue they helped produce would be seen as greedy malicious immoral exploiters to be jailed killed with impunity. Christians, Muslims, Jews, etc. who provided a moral basis for the freedom to not go along with socialist mythology morality would be seen as immoral enablers of capitalist exploitation and subject to persecution. Since religious people saw the atheistic socialists who were persecuting them, not as economically ideologically misguided, but as being evil, satanic, etc., which the atheist Darwinian rational socialists found absurd, this made it even easier for socialists to persecute and rid themselves of these allegedly irrational myth-believers who got in the way of all the great progress socialism would allegedly bring. Since the emergence of modern capitalism summarized above occurred first in Europe, many white people thought that their race or identity was a significant factor in the rapidly growing prosperity which fueled some European imperialism and racism. This also had the disastrous effect of causing many non-Europeans to see capitalism as some exploitative ideology used by white Europeans to exploit others, thus making non-Europeans, Asians, Africans, the Middle East, even more susceptible to socialist myths. To this day, the so-called political left still naively sees things in terms of racist capitalist exploitation by America West whites. The Soviets, socialists would further fool themselves in other subtle but important ways. For example, the Soviet Union was the home of most of the world's best chess players from 1927 to 1993. They were also the first to put a man in space, Yuri Gagarin, among other accolades which fooled them into a misguided sense of superiority which understandably kept the socialist myths going. Having spent most of our evolutionary history as tribal smarter apes, we have simply not evolved to intuitively understand the recently emerged evolutionary forces and market mechanisms like money, competitive knowledge discovery, finance, banking, etc. that create the social order, the vital need for freedom and privatization, and the immense harm that too much government can do. Tribal warfare, political infighting, coercing each other, rape, and the law of the jungle, are things we have been doing for millions of years and are somewhat intuitive, commercial society and understanding the aforementioned economic concepts which have been around for less than a few thousand is not. The dodo bird quickly went extinct because it had not evolved to recognize humans as potential dangers. We similarly just line up for central planning and government-coordinated self-destruction over and over. Notice how the biggest companies or private sector orders in the world like Amazon, Apple, Walmart, Google, and Microsoft, which hire and efficiently coordinate the actions of millions of fellow Homo sapiens across the world regardless of age, sex, religion or race, do not force anyone to buy their products or coerce anyone in any way and have no army or tribalistic and patriotic flag salutations. They spend all of their time peacefully innovating and copying each other's innovations, thus inadvertently spreading superior information and subsequent social order. Yet the human dodos hate the free private sector and love their coercive central planners, great leaders, and coercive monopolistic governmental structures which make it more difficult to overcome inferior ideas and also reinforces some tribal identity, Jews, Russians, Chinese, Americans, Cubans, etc., from which inevitably an us versus them mentality emerges. Little by little, with enough freedom, the slightly smarter apes eventually learn. Deng Xiaoping, who was the leading pro-free market Chinese reformer after Mao's passing, tells us. These were not just Mao's mistakes, they were all our mistakes. We are a backward country and we need to learn from Japan. Since economic ignorance is the root of our socio-economic problems, per Mises, it should be part of our civic duty to help fellow citizens overcome such ignorance. Mises writes, all reasonable men are called upon to familiarize themselves with the teachings of economics. This is, in our age, the primary civic duty. A myth is a widely held but false belief or idea. Wherever there is complexity, Homo sapiens easily fools himself with mythology. The complexity of the emergence and functioning of the socio-economic order has led to myths like the Tower of Babel, coercive and competition-immune rule by religious priesthoods as well as rule by government experts via socialism. The complexity of the biochemical order has led to myths like miasma theory and more recently lobotomies. The complexity of the economy, history, and human nature has led to our countless wars and current Israeli-Palestinian conflict. To discover and spread the best information and minimize falling for erroneous mythology, we just need to become experts in defending the freedom whose emerging peace and competitive knowledge discovery will provide us the best answers. Again, freedom is the ultimate algorithm.
So now, if we're going to deal with Zionism and all the chaos, we have to begin with anti-Jewish fallacies, right? Because it is from anti-Jewish fallacies and anti-Semitism that then we get Zionism and all the chaos that it has brought us. So let's look at some of these fallacies. So number one, misunderstanding ethnic Jewish overrepresentation in finance and banking. Now, the Islamic world and the Roman Catholic Church during medieval periods, they thought that charging interest on loans was immoral. So they did not allow Christians and Muslims to charge interest on loans. So they turned over the entire finance and banking industry to just the Jews, who were like 1% at most of the population, right? Inadvertently motivating the entire Western world to give them all of their savings. So that is understandably going to give them far more power and influence than they would have otherwise had if they were competing with Christians and so on. Now, finance and banking does awesome things for society. It allows entrepreneurs to quickly gain big quantities of wealth so they can carry out big projects like skyscrapers and factories, which without finance and banking, there's no way you would have had enough friends and family to carry out such big projects. It also motivates people to save, right? You produce, then you save, right? You don't consume. You give your money to the bank. The bank gives the money to the entrepreneur, who then gets to consume the wealth that you didn't use up. So then they can consume that wealth while they do their big project, their skyscrapers, their factories, and then they make enough of a profit to pay back the interest, and then you can make some profit by lending your money to the bank. So that motivates society to be far more dynamic. It creates bigger projects, and it really is a great part of capitalism. So here's a great quote from historian Paul Johnson where he says, "The Jews reacted by engaging in the one business where Christian laws actually discriminated in their favor, and so became identified with the hated trade of moneylending. Rabbi Joseph Kolon, who knew both France and Italy in the second half of the 15th century, wrote that the Jews of both countries hardly engaged in any other profession." So they were mostly moneylenders, and if you're economically ignorant, like Hitler was, you're going to hate them for it. But again, that's a fallacy. Another very popular fallacy is misunderstanding ethnic Jewish overrepresentation in socialist, communist, and the Bolshevik calamity. So let's look a little bit at that. So socialist movements inadvertently had a massive ethnic Jewish overrepresentation. There is Jewish leading socialist ideologue Karl Marx, Lenin's sidekick and founder of the Red Army, Leon Trotsky, born Lev Davidovich Bronstein, was offered by Lenin to be the first leader of what would become the Soviet Union. But Trotsky turned down the idea and told Lenin, "You know very well that a Jew can't be premier in Russia," end quote. Jewish author Yuri Sleshkine writes in his excellent book, The Jewish Century, quote, "At the first All-Russian Congress of Soviets in June 1917, at least 31% of Bolshevik delegates and 37% of Unified Social Democrats were Jews. Furthermore, 5 out of 12 Bolshevik Central Committee members at the October 10, 1917 meeting, which voted to launch an armed insurrection, were ethnic Jews. Jews, at least in Lenin's Russia, were on average better educated, thus inadvertently rising to the top of the tyrannical ideology bureaucracy, which required the better educated to coerce the rest." So Lenin mentions, "The fact that there were many Jewish intelligentsia members in the Russian cities was of great importance to the revolution. They put an end to the general sabotage that we were confronted with after the October Revolution. The Jewish elements were mobilized and thus saved the revolution at a difficult time. It was only thanks to this pool of a rational and literal labor force that we succeeded in taking over the state apparatus." So it is true that the ethnic Jews played a massive role in the Bolshevik calamity. But again, it wasn't really like their fault. Now, they were unfortunately overly represented in the Soviet secret police that was tasked with destroying all the churches and killing all opposition. Yuri Sleshkine mentions again, in 1923, at the time of the creation of the OGPU, the Cheka successor, the rebranding of the secret police, Jews made up 15.5% of all leading officials and 50% of the top brass, 4 out of 8 members of the Collegium Secretariat. Socially alien Jews were well represented among the Cheka OGPU prisoners, too. But Leonard Shapiro is probably justified in generalizing, especially about the territory of the former Pale, that was a chunk of Russia where there were a lot of Jews, that, quote, anyone who had the misfortune to fall into the hands of the Cheka stood a very good chance of finding himself confronted with and possibly shot by a Jewish investigator. Right? So the Jews really were high up doing a lot of the killing. Now, but this is very important. Notice how he says Jews were well represented among the Cheka OGPU prisoners, which wouldn't have been the case had the Bolshevik Revolution been some pro-Jewish ideology, as a lot of misguided thinkers believe. Now, in just 13 years, from 1927 to 1940, the Soviet secret police, unfortunately, with a significant overrepresentation of ethnic Jews, destroyed 29,084 Christian Orthodox churches, leaving less than 500, while killing an estimated 80,000 to 100,000 priests. I know, massive bloodbath.
Now, this is something, sorry to interrupt, this is something I hear like Candace Owens maybe sometimes fall exactly. for some fallacies where it sounds like she gets on kind of an anti-Semitic sounding rant and it's yeah. these Jews, they killed all these Christians. Sorry to interrupt you, Jorge, but no. I do think this is important material.
Yeah, I mean, but just because Jews find themselves overrepresented in a disastrous ideology doesn't mean that they plotted it, you know, with a sinister purpose. If we're going to blame them for the Bolshevik Revolution, then we have to give them credit for giving us, you know, the God of Abraham, the Ten Commandments, Christianity, Islam, right? Mm. It's a huge mistake to credit something that is the result of complex, you know, historical evolution, you know, for pure malice or genius.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Continue.
No, great, thanks. So these above factors that I just mentioned erroneously made it seem to naive thinkers like Hitler, who famously writes in Mein Kampf, quote, in Russian Bolshevism, we ought to recognize the kind of attempt which is being made by the Jew in the 20th century to secure dominion over the world. You see, he's mistakenly seeing the Bolshevik Revolution as the Jews trying to take over the world, you know. So seeing the Jews purposely, thinking that the Jews purposely conspired socialism for nefarious purposes, including destroying Christianity, Islam, religion, instead of the truth that per Karl Menger, it is the unintended product of historical development, not malicious conspiracy, that led to ethnic Jews being overrepresented in this disastrous ideology. Right? Now, another fallacy, a misunderstanding ethnic Jewish overrepresentation in pornography, LGBT stuff, you know, and things like that. I mean, that just happens. You know, the Jews, a lot of them are very secular. They're more likely to be Darwinians. You know, if you're more secular and Darwinian, you're more understandably likely to break away from established religious morals. So you're going to be overrepresented in any of these movements where they treat human beings, you know, for the slightly smarter apes that we are. So they're going to be more overrepresented in pornography, LGBT stuff and all that. I mean, there's a reason why the Bible tells women, thou shall not lay with a beast. Remember, you know, not to have sex with animals or something like that. I mean, human beings, before we became civilized, you know, we were very animalistic and so on. So again, that's why the Jews are overrepresented. But then you have a lot of naive anti-Semites saying that the Jews invented pornography, that they invented transgenderism, right? They make the mistake of looking at Jewish overrepresentation of something and blaming them for it. I am a secular Darwin, I'm not for all these things, but again, I'm much more tolerant of these things than a lot of other people. So again, that's another major fallacy. And that's another reason why they're overrepresented in Hollywood. And again, ideological movements that deviated from established religious norms. Like Candace Owens is always talking about how the Jews, they do psychoanalysis, and it was Freud, who was a Jew, who brought us all this psychobabble. So again, she's making the mistake. This has nothing to do with just like your Jewishness. It just comes from a sign of the times and the fact that a lot of them were secular and they abandoned religious inherent.
Dan Balzerian falls for a lot of this.
Oh, yeah. We'll have a few quotes from him. And then the last one I'll mention is just the religious influence anti-Jewish fallacies. I mean, whether the Jews really had something to do with killing Jesus or not a couple of thousand years ago, it's a mistake to now suddenly look at the Jews of today and label them as satanic or say that they're evil because, you know, they killed Jesus or you know, the synagogue of Satan, you know, and things like that. So again, or still calling them usurers. you still see a lot of people that calling that call them usurers. They're responsible for high interest rates. And again, more fallacies. Those are all fallacies. Okay, so now that we discussed the fallacies, now Zionism, as is carried out, doesn't overcome the fallacies. So it is doomed for failure. So now let us look at it. So as a reaction to lingering anti-Semitic fallacies in Europe in the late 1800s, especially in or near Russia, where legal restrictions against Jews remained and most Zionist ideologues came from, secular Jews like Herzl, Theodor Herzl, I got his picture there, fooled themselves and the West into attempting to overcome anti-Semitism, not via reason, logic, sympathy for misguided, and education, which are the only ways fallacies can be overcome, but via Zionism. For the secular Herzl, Zionism was just one of his ideas, like converting Jews to Christianity, you know, which we know he tried, to overcome anti-Semitism, which, like slavery and unequal treatment of women, was also rapidly disappearing already. Now, central to Zionist ideology mythology is the fallacy that in order to overcome anti-Semitism, which many erroneously see as some irrational hate, the world's oldest, of course, that can't be overcome via reason and education like other fallacies, Jews must abandon the organically evolved and time-tested humble synagogues, cultures, languages, towns, and cities where they had lived with non-Jews for centuries in increasingly peaceful and harmonious ways to create a Jewish state in the most sacred of areas that was overwhelmingly populated by Muslims, Christians, and many Jews who were adamantly opposed to living under a Jewish state. A state with a coerced atheist, Herzl-designed Jewish flag, anthem, national identity, concocted by misguided European ideologues who inherited many of the racist and socialist fallacies of their times. David Ben-Gurion, Israel's architect and the first prime minister, was an atheist and socialist who eagerly attended Moscow in 1923 to celebrate the 7th anniversary of the Bolsheviks, you know, October Revolution, and get a glimpse of his hero, Lev Davidovich Bronstein, Trotsky. Now, Benzion Netanyahu, Bibi's dad, wrote and believed absurdities like, quote, if a nation says out of conviction, I am strong and forceful, then it becomes strong and forceful. This is the law of greatness. Yeah, I mean, this is, again, impressive if written in cursive, you know, by a four-year-old, but an absurd basis for creating a country in the most sacred of locations. I mean, the bottom line is that all these early Zionist ideologues, they were just totally clueless ideologues. That's just the way it is. Now, Zionism was wisely rejected by most Jews when Herzl began to seriously organize for it. The rabbinical establishment, reflecting the views shared by most Jews in Munich, Germany, where Herzl wanted to have the first Zionist Congress in 1897, strongly rejected the idea. So the meeting was moved to Basel, Switzerland. They told him, quote, we comprise a separate community solely with respect to religion. Regarding nationality, we feel totally at one with our fellow Germans and therefore strive towards the realization of the spiritual and moral goals of our dear fatherland with an enthusiasm equaling theirs. This makes sense. The German Jews spoke German. The Spanish Jews spoke Spanish. They have been in those communities, you know, forever. Leading Zionist after Herzl's death, Chaim Weizmann lamented how, quote, for assimilated Jews, they looked upon it, Zionism, as a primitive tribalism. They felt themselves called upon to rescue Judaism from Zionism. These people are dead against Zionism. So a lot of these Jews, they wanted to rescue Judaism from the Zionist calamity, but ultimately they failed and the Zionist calamity expanded. Just like socialist identity morality replaced the previous identity morality of Russians, Chinese, unfortunately Cubans, and other cultures as it attempted to create the socialist man who was to be selfless, learned, healthy, muscular, and enthusiastic about spreading the communist revolution and criminalize dissent. So would Zionists design a new identity, as leading Zionist ideologue Vladimir Jabotinsky writes in his must, oh no, no, as he writes here, he says, quote, take the Yid Jew of today and try to imagine in our minds his exact opposite. The Yid is ugly, sickly, and lacks handsomeness. We shall endow the ideal image of the Hebrew, you know, the new Jew Zionist, with masculine beauty. The Yid is disgusting to all. So it was a social engineering project, as we've talked with our favorite Rabbi Shapiro. And also, like the socialists, the Zionists compounded the problem by tying their identity to a flawed new morality that has to be coerced upon the entire world. As Jabotinsky writes in his must-be-read article, The Iron Wall, written in 1923, he writes, quote, we hold that Zionism is moral and just. And since it is moral and just, justice must be done. No matter whether Joseph or Simon or Ivan or Ahmed agree with it or not, there is no other morality. And he also said regarding the Arabs that culturally, they are 500 years behind us. And he was saying that at a time where so many of these Zionists were actually communists, which is even worse. Now, so now if we fast forward to the present, look where we are now. We have Anti-Defamation League, Jonathan Greenblatt, the CEO, saying that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is genocide. So he would have, I mean, we're getting to the point, they would have put in jail the Jews of the late 1800s who thought that Zionism was a total error. But that's where we're going. Now, the very wise Shlomo Sand, Israeli-born author of the great books, The Invention of the Land of Israel, The Invention of the Jewish People, he nailed it when he said, Zionism has become a sort of Stalinism, because, I mean, that is really where it's going. So another very important thing about Zionism, again, Zionism made no effort whatsoever to overcome anti-Semitism. The way it dealt with anti-Semitism was like, whenever there's any anti-Semitism, it says, oh, look, let's print it in the newspapers. Look how evil all the anti-Semites are. You know, give us money for our Zionism. We got to do our Zionism. We got to preach our Zionism. So the Theodor Herzl very famously writes, quote, the anti-Semites will become our most dependable friends. The anti-Semitic countries are allies. Great exertions will hardly be necessary to spur on the movement. Anti-Semites provide the requisite impetus. They need only do what they did before, and then they will create a desire to emigrate where it did not previously exist and strengthen it where it existed before, right? So it's very important, right, to see that anti-Semitism and Zionism are both fallacies that grow and they feed each other, right? And here's where I have, you know, this tweet from Dan Bilzerian mentioning what you mentioned earlier. So Dan Bilzerian says, Jews should pay Holocaust reparations to the families of the 60 million Christians they killed during the Bolshevik genocide. Massive error, right? And Candace Owens, I got her here at the top. Candace Owens said, what we are watching right now, you know, with the Gaza calamity, is the synagogue of Satan led by Bibi Netanyahu, right? So we have anti-Jewish fallacies, which grow Zionist power. Very important too. You know,
Candace Owens is good on so much, but it is very important. I would say Candace is better on average than Dan is. Dan seems to fall for maybe a historically high number of anti-Semitic fallacies.
I think so too. I think he's a bit more hardcore. Yeah, but again, it's a double-edged sword because these people are bringing so many people to think about this. And we need that as well. It's really a double-edged sword. It really fits the perfect.
It almost seems like Dan Bilzerian at times works for Israel.
Oh. I mean, who knows if behind the scenes, you know, some Zionists are giving them money. Oh, yeah, go ahead, increase the anti-Semitic nonsense. We'll see right now, more money for Palantir stock. You know, I got stock in all the companies that are going to lock you down and send you to jail. I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating, but...
Primary Randy Fine. Sure, that's a great spectacle. Make a spectacle of it.
Oh, yeah, anti-Semitism is rising. You know, yeah, but very tricky. It's really hard to see where things are going. And that's why we need to do the best that we can so we can steer things, you know, in the right direction. So when Jews were in an environment that restricted their freedom, in some ways they evolved to be a catalyst for freedom, for nonviolence and understanding to overcome fallacies leading to their ill-treatment. They had no other choice, which carried over to their famed overrepresentation in fighting for the freedoms of African Americans. Unfortunately, Zionist ideologues disastrously married the growing sympathy for minorities and individual rights with Zionism's fallacies, turning the increasingly Zionized Jews into a dangerous fifth column similar to communist activists and intellectuals, but for flawed Zionist ideas, with their moral pontifications and vilifications creating moral environments which inevitably increased Jew-Gentile polarizations, frictions, wars, and chaos. Now, very important, for example, before Hitler became chancellor in January 30, 1933, simple-minded Zionist ideologues at the World Jewish Congress of August 1932, they mentioned that, quote, the Jews can only respond by taking active boycott measures, and only historical necessity forces the nation to fight back with the methods borrowed from its enemies, end quote. Soon after Hitler becomes chancellor, Zionist leaders foolishly led a huge anti-Nazi protest at the Madison Square Garden March 27, 1933 that was attended by 40,000 people pushing for boycotts. A few days later, on April 1st, the Nazis, just as foolishly, organized a one-day boycott of Jewish businesses. So the polarizations continued with Hitler's law for the restoration of the professional civil service, passed a few days later on April 7th, barring Jews from certain types of jobs. So we can see the polarizations starting to, you know, to grow. Now, plenty of non-Zionized Jews and Germans wanted to peacefully overcome the fallacies and were opposed to the growing vilifications. The May 3rd, 1935 issue of The Orthodox, a New York-based Orthodox Jewish newspaper, strongly opposed the boycott. And I got this from our rabbi friend.
Rabbi Shapiro, but our mystery rabbi friend.
Yes. So they wrote in their newspaper, they said, quote, regarding the boycott, this is against the principles of our faith, which commands, quote, when you come to your enemy, call him for peace. The aim of the Jewish people is to seek peace under all circumstances. Boycotting a nation may cause the suffering of innocent people, and this surely would not be in the spirit of the teachings of our forefathers. The present German government is doing wrong in persecuting the Jews, and it is the duty of our people to find ways and means to appeal and try to persuade the German government to change its attitude towards them and to prove that the Jew is a good citizen and is ready at all times to protect his country. This was proved in the last war. Thousands and thousands of Jews lost their lives to protect Germany. Therefore, we are against the boycott. But, unfortunately, but thoughtful Jews and Germans trying to use reason and logic to overcome the fallacies were no match for their respective Zionist mob and the Nazi self-righteous mobs, which intensified the polarizations and the calls for violence at both ends. The growing echo chamber of anti-Jewish fallacies by the Nazi government, which soon after in September 15, 1935, passed the even more absurd and racist Nuremberg race laws, and Zionist fallacies with their focus on moral condemnations, boycotts, violence, and separation to overcome anti-Jewish fallacies, would keep Zionizing the Jews and Western politicians. In February 9, 1938, about a year and a half before the outbreak of World War II, the Polish ambassador in Washington, Count Jerzy Potocki, reported back home to the foreign minister in Warsaw, and this is what he said. He said, the pressure of the Jews on President Roosevelt and on the State Department is becoming ever more powerful. The Jews are right now the leaders in creating a war psychosis, which would plunge the entire world into war and bring about a general catastrophe. This mood is becoming more and more apparent, and have above all raised the banner of burning hatred against Nazism. This hatred has become a frenzy. It is propagated everywhere and by every means, in theaters, in the cinema, in the press. The Germans are portrayed as a nation living under the arrogance of Hitler, which wants to conquer the whole world and drown all of humanity in an ocean of blood. In conversations with Jewish press representatives, I have repeatedly come against the inexorable and convinced view that war is inevitable. This international Jewry exploits every means of propaganda to oppose any tendency towards any kind of consolidation and understanding between nations. In this way, the conviction is growing steadily but surely in public opinion here that the Germans and their satellites in the form of fascism are enemies who must be subdued by the democratic world. We're seeing the same thing. Shapiro, Mark Levin, everything is, we have to unite to destroy the evildoers. Of course, Hitler was an anti-Semite, and we'll get to that in a second. But you can
when you
see,
say Shapiro, you mean Ben Shapiro.
Ben Shapiro, sure, sorry, yeah. Now, also very important, on September 11, 1941, about 2 months before the U.S. entered World War II, American hero and the first man to fly nonstop across the Atlantic Ocean, Charles Lindbergh, delivered his famous speech in St. Louis to keep the U.S. out of the war and warning how the majority of Jews, for understandable reasons, were making the error of pushing for war. He mentions, quote, it is not difficult to understand why Jewish people desired the overthrow of Nazi Germany. The persecution they suffered in Germany would be sufficient to make bitter enemies of any race. No person with a sense of the dignity of mankind can condone the persecution of the Jewish race in Germany. But no person of honesty and vision can look at their pro-war policy here today without seeing the dangers involved in such a policy for both for us and for them. Instead of agitating for war, the Jewish groups in this country should be opposing it in every possible way, for they will be among the first to feel its consequences. Tolerance is a virtue that depends upon peace and strength. History shows that it cannot survive war and devastations. A few far-sighted Jewish people realize this and stand opposed to intervention, but the majority still do not. He nailed it. Wisdom, reason, logic, but the Zionist mob was already just unstoppable. This growing Zionized environment with its incessant good versus evil moral pontifications inevitably led to the selection, evolution, or emergence of simple-minded good versus evil great leaders like Winston Churchill and the unnecessary destruction of Germany and much of Europe via World War II at the cost of 80 million lives and the subsequent horrible expansion of communism to China and other areas. Only naive and likely Zionized people can refer to any war, and much less the deadliest of all wars, as the good war. It's bullshit. Violence cannot possibly overcome fallacies, whether it's hate speech laws, and much less an entire war where millions of people are just slaughtering each other, right? That doesn't overcome the errors. Okay, now.
Frustrating, huh?
Oh, yeah. So after Zionized ideologues succeeded in persuading the U.S. to enter World War II, leading Zionist Chaim Weizmann mentioned the obvious. This is our war. In a speech on December 3rd, 1942 in New York, he mentioned, quote, "We are not denying and are not afraid to confess that this is our war and that it is waged for the liberation of Jewry. Stronger than all fronts is our front, that of Jewry. We are not only giving this war our financial support on which the entire war production is based. We are not only providing our full propaganda power, which is the moral energy that keeps this war going." Again, today, who is creating the moral environment of good versus evil that we have to destroy Russia, destroy China, you know, everybody who is somehow connected to the Palestinians and the whole Israeli-Palestinian mess. We're just seeing a repeat of the connection of the fallacies. Now, right now, Trump either attacks Iran and Russia with our partners, of course, or he is with the terrorists, as Mark Levin loves to say, the woke Reich, right? Zionist Jews are spreading violence as they see fit to overcome anti-Semitism. First Hitler, I get it, I understand, and now everyone who is an anti-Zionist. That's just the way it is. And now let me say something very important. Hitler, of course, held anti-Jewish fallacies. You know, I recommend people read my little article for the Mises Institute, The Economic Fallacies Underpinning Hitler's Disastrous Views, which grew thanks to the Zionists' understandable desire to destroy his regime, right? With boycotts and an eventual war. However, the future of civilization may depend on this seemingly obvious fact. Vilifying and attempting to harm people making errors, whether they're Zionists, anti-Semites, socialists, etc., instead of overcoming them via reason, sympathy, and education, is also a mistake, just as responsible, if not more so, for all the polarizations and chaos.
So let me get this clear, Jorge. Are you saying you're not a big fan of Hitler?
I'm not a big fan of Hitler. He's another human being that had ideas that entered his mind, and there were fallacies. We have to overcome the fallacies. Hitler made a lot of errors, and that's what I tried to describe in my little article, the racial errors. He was a national socialist, socialism, you know, another error, and obviously all the anti-Jewish fallacies. But we have to overcome the fallacies. Just blowing up an entire country, Dresden, terror night bombing, killing millions of people. The Germans were like the most civilized people in Europe, and they got incinerated. You know, the average member of the Nazi party had no idea. You know, it was just a normal person. That is the truth. And anyway, the wars never overcome the fallacies. Now let's get to the Holocaust and all the ramifications that is going on with this. So the first, I mean, it's such a big subject. It's even hard to even start with this. But the first thing I'll mention regarding the Holocaust is that publicly stating that gas chambers were not used to kill millions of Jews is a crime in over 20 countries or 25, you know, depending kind of like how you say it and where you're at. So, I mean, to me and from a libertarian perspective, the fact that a human being can be sent to prison just because some ideas make sense to them, I mean, that should just be so barbaric, you know? I mean, but anyway, so let's jump.
What does this chart show us? Could you go back there?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, this
what are those years? What are those years mean? Yeah. 2014 for Russia, Sweden, 2024. Please elaborate.
Those are the years in which they passed Holocaust denial laws.
In each of those countries. So starting in 2024 in Sweden, you can go to jail if you say that gas chambers were not used to kill Jews in the Holocaust?
Yeah. Even in Canada, 2 years ago, they already passed denial laws.
Wow. So it is trending in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the United States has stood strong.
So far, but we can see the mob, you know, where the mob is going. You know, again, we're equally human. If all of these civilized places and the Canadians, you know, who are so nice, they do this. I mean, we still have the best traditions of freedom here and all hell is going to break loose when they try it. But it's going to happen. That's what we have to be ready. We have to be prepared to defend freedom of speech and to understand this incredibly complex subject, which is about to hit.
If someone is listening on Spotify or iTunes, check out the YouTube video. You can see these slides. Hopefully YouTube does not remove this episode, right?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. We'll upload it to Rumble too.
Okay.
Okay, so here are some very prominent Holocaust deniers already. I mean, we got Dan Bilzerian, the king of Instagram with 30 million subscribers. Pinned on the top of his Twitter feed is the interview he had with Piers Morgan, where he denied the Holocaust. And it already has like millions and millions of views. And we also have Jake Shields. He had Germar Rudolph, who's a Holocaust scholar. He had him twice on his show. Five-time MMA world champion, a very famous influencer. Myron Gaines is another popular influencer. He had Germán Rudolph on his podcast as well. And we also have Nick Fuentes. You know, everybody already knows, you know, who Nick Fuentes is. Now, very important. I put in parentheses here, low IQ. These people are very bright. They don't have low IQ. But the point I want to make is that when these people criticize Zionism, they make a lot of anti-Jewish fallacies, right? And that's why I want to put the low IQ label. You know, if you're spreading a lot of anti-Jewish fallacies, you're saying they created the Bolsheviks, you're calling them satanic and all these things, that's why I put that label in there. And these four men, as much as I respect their courage and all the great things that they're doing, they also make a lot of these low IQ anti-Jewish fallacies. So that's
potentially a net negative to the cause, these four men?
It's impossible. It's way too complex. Nobody can tell whether the incredible attention that they're bringing up on this vital subject, we really have to see what happens in the future. If very soon the police already, you know, Palantir, pretty soon they start passing some denial laws here in the United States and the police state grows just like we have with COVID mania and we end up going to jail and we just have a total disaster and the United States turns into Europe and Germany. I mean, notice that all the hoopla over anti-Semitism or the funding of the wars, all the chaos is happening in the United States because we are the only country where we really have freedom of speech. And people can talk about all these things. And even if you doubt the Holocaust, nobody's going to come and take you away. In Germany, forget it. In Germany, everybody's ready to do whatever the president of Germany is ready to tell them. Oh, we got to go out there and fight the Russians? Oh, we got to do it. Otherwise, you're an anti-Semite. Oh, you got to send more money to Israel? Oh, if you don't do it, you're an anti-Semite. So only in the United States do we have the freedom of speech to be able to turn this thing around. So it really depends what's going to happen in the future. I mean, I really respect these people. And I hope that eventually, you know, they turn it around and they cut down on some of their anti-Jewish fallacies and stick only to the good information.
I know Jake Shields personally. I don't think he works for the CIA. I don't know.
I don't think so.
You don't think any of them are plants to feed into anti-Semitism? What are your thoughts on that, Jorge?
I don't think so. And it's interesting because, you know, they start accusing each other of that. A lot of people have said that Dick Fuentes is funded by the CIA. You know, you start hearing all of these things. I really don't think that any of them, like, work for the CIA.
It does feed into what Mark Levin and Ben Shapiro want to hear entirely. They want more of this. There's no denying that.
No. True. Again, it's a double-edged sword. Maybe they're doing more harm. Maybe they're doing more good. We have to see what happens. If we are able to spread the right ideas on time and calm the tensions and solve all of this chaos, because the truth is that millions of people are at least looking at this thanks to these men. And they have immense courage, right? I mean, I really respect these people, even though I disagree with them in some ways. I mean, these people really are, in many ways, American heroes. I mean, Nick Fuentes is a badass. He makes a shitload of errors. He says all kinds of stupid things, economically ignorant, praising Stalin, and all kinds of nonsense. But again, you know, I'm very much a Misesian. I focus on the fallacies. If these people are making some errors, fine, let's focus on those errors. I'm not going to want to have some hate speech laws and put them in jail just because they might make some anti-Semitic errors.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, they should not be put
exactly.
in jail.
Exactly. But that's how the mob thinks. You know, the mob says, oh, you're saying something anti-Semitic. You, as a whole person, even though you might have a job, you might be a good father, you might be a good engineer, you're a criminal now. It's awful. We need to focus on the fallacies and have freedom of speech to overcome the fallacies and certainly not have hate speech laws or any of these things.
Agreed.
So anyway, so that's these men. But now let's talk about what I like to call the high IQ Holocaust deniers.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Here we go. These are the scholars, the people who know the history of all this, and they know that the Holocaust is not some conspiracy by the Jews, you know, or they don't make, you know, these anti-Jewish fallacies. You know, these people, and they explain things in a totally different way, as I will try to get into here very quickly. So let me say a few things about these five men that I have here. So number one, I'll start with Ron Unz. So Ron Unz, he's Jewish born, okay? Jewish born. He studied history and physics, has graduate degrees from Harvard, Cambridge, and Stanford, okay? He runs the excellent site, Unz.com. He wrote a superb essay called Holocaust Denial, Analyzing the History of a Controversial Movement, okay? Next, okay, Murray Rothbard. It doesn't get any bigger in the world of freedom, okay? Murray Rothbard, Jewish born as well. Prolific economist and historian, the intellectual father of the Libertarian Party. Even on the Libertarian Party webpage, it says so, okay? He's the co-founder of the Cato Institute and the Ludwig von Mises Institute, arguably the two leading free market think tanks in the entire world, okay? He's Javier Milei's favorite intellectual. Javier Milei mentioned of Rothbard. He said, the person who has been the greatest inspiration in my life is essentially Murray Newton Rothbard. And he also said that we are fulfilling Rothbard's dream, end quote. Rothbard was a huge admirer of arguably the greatest American historian ever, Harry Elmer Barnes, who was a denier, and wrote in 1951, Harry Elmer Barnes wrote, quote, if world policy today cannot be divorced from the mythology of the 1940s, a third world war is inevitable. He nailed it. Way back in 1951, he knew that this good versus evil that was growing from all the myths from World War II were going to polarize the planet and lead to a third world war. So we're running out of time. So next, Jewish-born Paul Eisen, he wrote a classic essay called The Holocaust Wars, and other essays like How I Became a Holocaust Denier and My Life as a Holocaust Denier. He's a great example of moral fortitude and courage for Jews to learn from. Because here you have one of your own who describes growing up believing in all the Zionist myths and the Holocaust myths and how he, you know, turned it around. So he's a great person for Jews to overcome all the myths. Arthur Butz, MIT engineering graduate, PhD in engineering from University of Minnesota, another real scientific badass. There's no, you know, Jews are satanic nonsense, you know, in disguise. So he wrote a classic book on the Holocaust in 1976 already called The Hoax of the 20th Century. I do not like that title for reasons I will explain very soon, but he's another important person. And lastly, Germar Rudolph. He's a German chemist. He spent nearly 4 years in jail for writing a chemistry report that cast doubt into the mass gassing's narrative. He's the leading publisher of scholarly revisionist denial material. All of his books are available for free at Holocaust Handbooks. And look, he's a fellow free marketeer. Here he is at the final resting place of Ludwig von Mises. And he has a shirt, right? Trust the experts, with three Jewish free market economists, with Murray Rothbard, with Mises, and Friedman. So we'll say more about him soon.
Real quick, can I ask a question? You did not include who is arguably the most famous Holocaust denier, David Irving. Thoughts on Irving?
Oh, I have something on him a little later.
Okay.
I don't know if he's the most famous. I mean, maybe he is. He's extremely famous and super important. He will be mentioned here. Oh, yeah. He's another very important person. I should have mentioned him, actually. Sorry.
I'm not saying that.
No. I'm really glad you brought it up because he's a very important person. But he shows up a little later here. Okay. Now, these people were not some of the initial ones I had, but I'm sure you might have heard that Tucker Carlson 2 years ago had probably the most famous historian today, as far as like the intern and so on, is Daryl Cooper. And Daryl Cooper was with Tucker Carlson a couple of years ago, and Daryl Cooper said how Churchill was really like the main guy who ended up, you know, exploding the Second World War. And
in the first, maybe.
Oh, yeah, played a big role in the First World War as well. And this is what Daryl Cooper also mentioned in interview. He said, quote, I told the students at the University of Vienna, where he was giving a talk, I said, over the next couple of decades, we're going to get to a point where the interwar period and the Second World War are far enough away that people can actually start taking a more honest look at everything that went on. And it is going to be the most fruitful place that any aspiring historian can dive into, because we spent the last 70 years, in Europe's case, literally throwing people in jail for looking into the wrong corners, particularly in Austria. Everybody knows what he's talking about. There's only one thing they put you in jail for regarding history in Austria, and that is the Holocaust. Wow. Right? Now, I do not know Daryl personally. I do not know Tucker Carlson personally, but as he said that, Tucker Carlson was like, oh, yeah, you know, they put you in jail for this thing. So I wouldn't be surprised if behind the scenes, they already know, you know, because this thing is really growing. So it's very, you know, we're getting there. Now I'm going to try to give like a 7-minute version of what I like to call the high IQ version of the Holocaust. Okay, this is what the real scholars, how they see the Holocaust. The Holocaust is not some conspiracy by the Jews and all this stuff. It comes from what is called like the fog of war. So let's get into it. So the great comedian and critic George Carlin astutely mentioned, quote, you don't need a formal conspiracy when interests converge. The fog of war, you know, what they call the fog of war, right? With its understandable hatreds, violence, rumors, exaggerations, and vengeful or noble lies, right? Where people stretch the truth a little bit for a good cause, causes many people's interests convert in a manner where atrocity myths easily arise. For example, during World War I, rumors, exaggerations, and lies created the myth that the Germans were some bestial Huns who would bayonet and chop off the hands of Belgian babies. This was such a big deal at the time, as historian Thomas Fleming writes, quote, Clarence Darrow, the famously iconoclastic American lawyer, went to France later in 1915 and searched in vain for a single eyewitness who could confirm even one of the stories of the. And here I have a World War I poster showing the evil Germans chopping off, you know, and killing Belgian babies who are splattered on the floor here with blood on his stuff. So that is an example of myths arising from the First World War. Now, a more recent example is the 40 beheaded babies myth that quickly emerged during the initial months of the October 7th war between Israel and Hamas, and was primarily based on the lies and exaggerations of one Israeli soldier and a couple of people picking up dead bodies. So the excellent documentary Atrocity Inc. by Max Blumenthal and What Really Happened on October 7th by Double Down News does a great job of showing this, and I'm going to now play a few minutes from their stuff.
Yossi Landau himself said that he never actually saw any atrocities take place, but that he used his imagination to tell the stories of the bodies he found.
When we go into a house, and we're using our imagination.
And what an imagination he has.
I would say about 280 bodies, 280 casualties. I would say 80% was tortured. Two piles of 10 children each were tied to the back, burned to death.
And when we go into a house, and we see on one side of the dining room, was parents, father and mother, hands tied to the back. And the other side of the room, against them, there was two children, a girl and a boy. The same position, they were tortured. Main thing, and I wouldn't call them animals, to open up to all the food that was prepared for the holiday, and these terrorists sitting and eating while torturing the father and the kids, their parents and the kids, they should see each other how they're being tortured. How evil could that be?
Landau's lies were promptly amplified by Israeli officials.
They took dozens of children, bound them up, burned them, and executed them. They beheaded soldiers.
Their American counterparts, including Secretary Antony Blinken, were equally obliging.
A family of four, a young boy and girl, 6 and 8 years old, and their parents around the breakfast table. The father, his eye gouged out in front of his kids. The mother's breast cut off. The girl's foot amputated. The boy's fingers cut off before they were executed. And then their executioner sat down and had a meal.
There was just one problem for Landau and those who amplified his questionable claims. No bodies found in Kibbutz Be'eri matched the descriptions he made. The story of the beheaded babies was also implausible according to official Israeli government data, which confirmed that only one baby, 11-month-old Myla Cohen, was killed on October 7th. Just one, and she was tragically shot by accident through a door, not decapitated.
I heard last...
Now, this is... Go
what's
ahead.
Crazy is you won't hear Mark Levin or Ben Shapiro or anybody, Blinken or Trump or anyone, acknowledge that those claims have been proven to be definitively false. You won't hear anyone own that. Which is very scary.
Yeah, yeah. It's politicians. You know, it's just, oh, well, you know, the newspaper will make a retraction because that has happened. They made retractions, some of the newspapers. At least they go that far. But then the politicians, you know, oh, well, who cares? You know, they're evil anyways. That's just the way it is.
What Max Blumenthal, arguably one of the best journalists on the planet, what he said there about only one baby was killed on October 7th? And the original stories, I remember where I was without going into details the day of October 7th, the people who were watching the Fox News and those types of outlets, it was all based on the beheading of babies and the craziest shit that you could think of. That's what the narrative was. They're so evil. They're animals. Listen to what they did to the kids.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these people live in this world. I mean, we're all equal human beings, but somehow, whether it's the Nazis, then we can just bomb them, or is the terrorist? I mean, we're all equally human. Everybody, you know, does it when they're caught up in their wars. And so here, I don't know if you know this guy, but this is Jonathan Pollard. He was a famous spy, you know, who, you know, went to Israel and so on. And here he is admitting that all the destruction that happened during the first weeks of the war, that it wasn't done by Hamas going out and just blowing up buildings, blowing up cars, and just killing people at random, like, you know, like we're supposed to believe, because we know that Hamas, they're not Homo sapiens like us, right? They're just a caricature of evil. They're just out there massacring people on purpose, because that's the world that some of these people live in. He's admitting that it was done by the Israelis themselves, right? But, and again, it's not, I don't want to blame the IDF soldiers. It is the fog of war. You got young men with weapons in a chaotic environment, and they're blowing up everything inside. And I'm sure you remember hearing about the Hannibal Directive, where the Israelis, they were like, you know, if you're not too sure, it's okay to blow up something else, even if you end up killing our own people, because they get taken hostage, then they're going to cause us more problems. So it's okay to just go out and just blow up all these things, right?
Dennis Prager says that the reason is because Hamas and the Muslims there, they love death more than they love life.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They're that different from us, of course, you know. So here's Jonathan Pollard.
Last week that the bulk of the damage in Gaza was caused by our soldiers. They just went ahead. All that destruction you see was caused primarily by our soldiers. This is what I've heard across the board by people from platoon, company, battalion, brigade, and divisional commanders.
Okay.
When the ICC investigates Israel for fake war crimes, this is pure anti-Semitism.
So Pollard hasn't turned on Israel.
Well,
right?
Sorry, I missed something very important.
Sorry.
I gotta go back.
This is pure anti-Semitism.
Now, look what happened. A little later, the world's most moral politicians already passed laws banning the denial of October 7 atrocities. Now, I gotta maximize this here. Give me one second. Whoa. It says, the law states, anyone who says or writes things denying the October 7th massacre with the intention of defending the terrorist organization Hamas and its partners, expressing sympathy for them or identifying with them, will be sentenced to 5 years in jail. Right? Now, how do you define the massacre? You know, exactly. So anyway, so this is just an example of these naive politicians once again putting into law something that changes through time, and one is not 100% sure of exactly what happened. So this is a great example of, again, idiotic politicians passing laws, making mistakes, making criminals out of people, especially in a historical event that we can see is changing all the time as people learn more and more. I mean, luckily they passed this law after it was known about the 40 beheaded babies. But just imagine if they had turned.
But who knows? If I have one of my Fox News watching friends tuning in, which hopefully I do, they still think the 40 beheaded babies story was true, don't they?
Yeah, well, good. Well, good for them to watch this. Yeah, but it's not.
I hope. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. So next, here, you might have seen this before. This was popular footage. Here you have a weatherman who is faking much stronger winds. You can see the people in the background. Did you see the people in the back walking like nothing was happening? And the weatherman is making it look like, oh my God, the winds are a lot stronger, right? Now, based on this, based on catching one weatherman exaggerating bad weather, it would be a huge mistake to say that all weathermen are a bunch of liars.
Mm.
Exactly, right? But what happens is that weathermen, they oftentimes find themselves in a situation where statistically, some of them, either for sensationalism, for ratings, or to a noble lie, to get people to be more careful, right? They're going to stretch the truth, right? So the same thing happens to Jews, right? Historically. The Jews historically have been a persecuted people, right? Every once in a while, you know, they get expelled. They have someone who mistreats them and they do not have recourse, you know, to the law or the police like they can. So they live in an environment of a fog of war. They historically live in an environment where spreading rumors and atrocity myths is something that we can expect to see, right? They're not necessarily liars. They find themselves in an environment where it makes perfect sense that rumors and atrocity myths are more likely to be spread. So the next thing I'm going to play is fascinating. It's the pages of a book that is called The First Holocaust, The Origin of the 6 Million Figure. And I'm going to quickly flash basically from the year 1850 to 1943, okay, over 200 times in newspaper articles. You might have heard about this or seen it. Over 200 times, the 6 million figure of 6 million Jews being expelled or suffering or about to be killed or implied and so on shows up in newspapers, right? So let me just play it real quick. I mean, anybody who watches this at home, they'll be able to just pause it and take a look. So there it is, the first Holocaust, just so people can pause them and see the content of all of these articles, right? So now again, naive thinkers will say, oh my God, the Jews are just liars. They're always exaggerating. They're always telling us lies, right? But no. A more astute person will say, wait a minute. No. These people live in an environment where they are being mistreated. And it makes sense that it's part of their culture to constantly be painting the people who are treating you so poorly as evildoers, as people who are going to commit massacres, because every once in a while, the Jews do get ill-treated. So it's very important to see these things.
Sure.
Exactly. So
makes
next
sense. Yeah. But at the same time, that's a very important, you know, collection of information leading up to the Holocaust narrative. And you saw Piers Morgan when he interviewed Nick Fuentes. He said, "Do you think 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust?" And Nick Fuentes said, "Oh yeah, of course, probably more." And Piers was like, "Yeah, I know. Like, It's like the people who have adopted this narrative as being just the truth. And if you deny the truth, then you're just a bad person. It's wild how strong it is, even in 2026.
Yeah. So next, this is Benny Morris. And he's probably the most important Israeli, the most famous Israeli historian, because he's one of the people who got in there and really started, you know, coming up with a lot of truths and a lot of things. And this is the only clip I'm actually going to have about the Zionist calamity. In 1948, there was a bit of a mini civil war, and the Israelis expelled 750,000 people, right? And then when the fighting ended, they did not allow them to return. And prior to this mass little expulsion, the Jews only owned about 7% of the land. And afterwards, they ended up controlling about 70% of the land. And suddenly now, if you're a pissed off Muslim trying to get your land back, you know, and you get upset now, you know, you're a terrorist, you know, you're an uncivilized person. So anyway, this is just a short clip of him, you know, with, it's a really good 2-minute section that is the least I could do for our little presentation here. Okay, so now we're going to deal with the actual Holocaust. So I'm not going to get too much into this. So I brought back from the dead Andriy Vyshinsky. Okay, so Andriy Vyshinsky will tell us the story of the Holocaust. And Andriy Vyshinsky was Stalin's top lawyer during the famous Scholl trials, where they ended up executing all kinds of people. But I'll just let him tell us the story.
Hello, I am Andriy Vyshinsky. I was Stalin's top legal authority during the Great Terror, where from 1936 to 1938, we executed from 700,000 to 1.2 million people. I was the lead prosecutor during the famed Moscow Scholl trials, where we made up false accusations, tortured, and executed leading Bolsheviks who could potentially threaten Stalin's power. Here is a great example of my legal oratory during the Moscow Scholl trials. Shoot these rabid dogs! Death to this gang who hide their ferocious teeth, their eagle claws, from the people! Down with that vulture Trotsky, from whose mouth a bloody venom drips, putrefying the great ideals of Marxism. Let's put these liars out of harm's way, these miserable pygmies who dance around rotting carcasses. Down with these abject animals. I was also the leading Soviet prosecutor during the post-World War II Nuremberg trials, and introduced fake evidence which blamed the Germans for the Katyn Forest massacre, where we Soviet communists killed over 20,000 leading Poles. Although Hitler and many leading Nazis were naive anti-Semites, and wanted to somehow get rid of Jews, the maniacal, purposeful extermination of 6 million Jews, primarily via gas chambers, is a myth that grew from fake atrocity evidence, which can be easily verified in the official trial documents, that the evil Nazis killed people via steam chambers, electrical chambers, atomic bomb-like device, having people climb trees and then cutting them down, a pedal-driven brain-bashing machine, and a bone-grinding machine, among other methods. Holocaust researcher and chemist Germar Rudolph writes,
during the war crimes trials, many eyewitnesses testify that Germans made soap out of human fat and lampshades from human skin. Allied prosecutors even produced evidence to support these charges. For decades, highly respected scholars at the most prestigious universities in the world sanctioned these stories, leading us to believe that such stories were irrefutable truths. But within time, many such stories have become untenable. In 1990, Yehuda Bauer, director of Holocaust studies at Hebrew University, Tel Aviv, admitted the Nazis never made soap from Jews.
One book I'd very much recommend would be...
This is Ron Unz.
Book by Nick Kollerstrom. It's sort of, I think, came out about 15 years ago. It's sort of, again, dealing with the Holocaust and dealing with Auschwitz and that sort of thing. And, you know, they're basically, they ended up releasing the wartime decrypts of the German communications. And those provide no indication of, you know, huge numbers of people being killed.
And this is Germar Rudolph, and I'll say a few more things about him.
Massive writings of wartime leaders mention no gas chambers. My chemical research shows how mass gassings cannot have taken place as believed. The current gas chamber stories are post-war inventions of non-Jewish Polish judges.
In 1991, Germar was a chemist working on his PhD at the prestigious Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research in Stuttgart, Germany, when he was hired to do some chemical analysis of the alleged Auschwitz gas chambers by attorney Hajo Hermann, who would defend Otto Ernst Remmer, a former top Wehrmacht officer, and believed that the mass gassings narrative was a myth lie. Based on his chemical analysis, Germar felt like the standard mass gassings narrative, in his own words.
Well, my conclusions are that the stories cannot be true for several reasons, for architectural reasons, for physical reasons, chemical reasons, and that it must have been at least in another way. You can't exclude absolutely that they have any gassings, maybe by another poisonous gas, maybe in a very small amount, or maybe on other places, in other ways. This is something you can't exclude absolutely. Before German courts, I would never have the chance to bring this report as a proof, because German courts do not accept any proof against the Holocaust stories.
When knowledge of his report reached German authorities, Germar was indicted, tried, and sentenced to 14 months in jail for allegedly inciting racial hatred. Germar fled Germany before serving his sentence. About 10 years later, in 2005, married and with a child in the U.S., Germar was deported to Germany, where he served his original sentence, and an additional 30 months as the result of a second trial before getting out in July 2009, after having spent over 3.5 years in jail. With respect to his trial and the absurdity and cruelty of the German legal system, Germar writes,
"In my own 2007 court case, I motioned to hear 5 mainstream historians, all of which would testify that the only reason why historians don't show any dissent about the Holocaust is because they are scared of being persecuted and prosecuted for it. And what was the judge's reaction to this? The motions are rejected because the gathering of this evidence is irrelevant for court's decision, because even if the named persons would confirm the probative allegations, the chamber would not question the self-evidence of the Holocaust."
Amazing. How can people who consider themselves civilized allow this to happen? As part of his trial, Germar gave long testimony explaining how such persecution went against everything Western culture had achieved and much more, and also took careful notes about the trial with the hope of someday publishing a book about the ordeal. From jail, Germar exchanged his trial notes and testimony with a supporter by mail, which would once again make him a criminal and bring another prosecution when authorities read his mail and discovered he was planning to once again publish forbidden ideas. Unfucking believable. Never again should we restrict the freedom of speech, whose emerging competition of ideas optimally guides our actions. I'm really sorry. We never intended to create the Holocaustianity religion, which fooled so many Jews and their rightly concerned sympathetic supporters. I can't believe people are labeled anti-Semites and thrown in prison for rightly questioning the gas chamber myth, given the easily verifiable facts above. Don't be a fucking pussy. Fight for freedom of speech. Let freedom and emerging competition of ideas be what gets us closer to the truth. Not the coercive, competition-immune monopoly edicts of naive tribalistic politicians and fanatical masses. Anyone who, knowing that they will be persecuted, and has the courage to voice their opinions, and thus engage in the vital competition of ideas which creates civilization, should be seen as a hero, regardless of whether they are right or wrong. Are we going to wait for the North Koreans to properly defend and explain the civilization-creating benefits of freedom of speech? I can't believe that of all people I have to be the one telling you this. You fucking ignorant cowards.
Okay. So, I mean, Vyshinsky, you know, those old Russians can be a little tough.
Yeah, he got a little frisky there at the end. Okay. He got a little frisky.
All right, we're almost done here. So now, Germar mentioned in one of his final books, recent books, he has a final paragraph that provides a great summary of the entire, you know, mess. So I just want to quote that one paragraph. So this is how the whole thing kind of like evolved. So Germar writes, quote, "The Polish underground, inside and outside the camps, invented and spread gas chamber rumors throughout the war, with both Jews and non-Jews participating. At war's end and thereafter, the communist Polish judiciary wrote the Nazi gas chamber narrative. To this day, their narrative is being taught and believed worldwide, and today even enforced by penal law in most Western countries. Just one Polish historian and 3 Polish judges played absolutely crucial roles in the formation of this narrative. As far as I can verify, none of them had a Jewish background. It's very important to realize that the mass gassings narrative is the result of understandably pissed off Polish communists, Russians, Stalinists, all of these people understandably wanting to get back at the Germans. And of course, you had a bunch of Jews in there as well who would go along with the myths. Now, understandably, as time went on, the Zionists would understandably, you know, hold on to this thing and blow it out of proportion to where it is today. But again, it's very important. This is where the low IQ Holocaust deniers, they'll tell you, oh, the Jews made up the whole thing. And then that really just fucks everything up. So Now, what are some of the ramifications of just this whole like nonsense? Here we have Rabbi Shmuley, you know, just to see how the Zionists have just fooled themselves in such disastrous ways. So Rabbi Shmuley, you know, this is very common Zionist talking points. In Gaza or Iran, every single person would be murdered. Israel is freedom. Israel is the light. You know, so the Soviets, right? The Soviets who were against irrationality, you know, they were for the science, for playing chess. They similarly painted the Christians, the Jews, and the Muslims as automatically being wrong, right? When it was the Soviets and their course of central planning, which was really the problem. So we see something similar with the Zionists. You know, they love to point at some of these things that might seem superior to suddenly say, oh no, we're right and they have to be wrong. You see how they, you know, how it's very easy, you know, to fool oneself that way. Now, socialism, and we mentioned this before, socialism understandably rose to the very top of the movement. It rose black people, whites, Asians, right? Because it was an ideology that appealed to everyone. Now, Zionism rises primarily Zionist Jews to the top, and you know, and some Zionist Christians. And today, right now, that's it. The U.S. has been totally Zionized, right? It's not the Constitution or the Ten Commandments that is really the main driver of what is going on in the United States today already. Per Jabotinsky, Zionism, right? There is no other morality. And sadly, we're seeing that right now with Thomas Massie. With Thomas Massie, we saw a guy who has an engineering degree from MIT. Everybody knows he's awesome on freedom, on economics, on everything. But we're reaching Bolshevik levels of like Zionification. Right? The Zionists, they see him. Remember, in the Soviet Union, you could be a bright locomotive engineer, but if you didn't have party purity, it was the local party boss who could get you killed. And that is what we're seeing right now, right? Randy Fine, all of the politicians, it's all about Zionism. It doesn't matter what else you're doing. If you're not doing what Bibi wants, you're a terrorist, right? It's becoming increasingly obvious that that's where we're headed, right?
If a MAGA person is listening, once again, I hope some of my MAGA friends are listening. They would say, Jorge, you sound very naive to compare the current U.S. government and the people who support it to, I mean, the actual evil people from World War II. What would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, we're not there yet, but I think we can see the signs of the ideology. I mean, look what just happened with COVID mania. Seemingly rational people, you know, suddenly turned on everyone else. We locked down society and we're obviously headed, you know, for something similar. We have Mark Levin and all these people saying, I mean, there's even rumors that they wanted to get Tucker Carlson because he talked to Putin, or you're talking to the Iranians. Therefore, you're siding with the enemy. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. We can see the patterns repeating history all the time. We can see the tribalisms just grow. And that's what I want to do. That's what we want to do. We want to show how Zionism is fracturing society into this ultimately error. And when you throw the Holocaust in there, it's going to make Holocaustianized Zionism even deadlier.
Hmm.
Right? So we're really reaching Bolshevik and Maoist cultural revolution levels of ideological purity over MIT engineer Massey, you know, wisdom. And sadly, you know, the more the Zionists brutalize the Islamic world with all the interventions over there, you know, the treatment of the Palestinians, the more stuck in poverty, in religious extremism, and anti-Semitism, they remain.
Sure.
And then you have, you know, the Zionists, they look at themselves in the mirror. Oh, we're the white people with the science, with the LGBT rights. This is further proof of
most moral army. They're the most moral army on the planet. Exactly. Jorge, you know that? They send pamphlets out before bombing children.
Well, yeah, exactly. So they look at themselves and they see all this extremism. Because they are fueling extremism by destroying all these countries and keeping them all poor. But again, just like the Soviets, they are just like the Soviets were too economically ignorant and disconnected from a complex chain reaction of things that led to their echo chamber of fallacies and perverse incentives that kept the deadly ideology going. It's the same thing for the Zionists, right? Most of the chaos is the result of Zionist ideology. But again, very important, it's not really their fault, because we can see how the anti-Semites, you know, provide, you know, the needed fuel for the Zionists to fool themselves into them doing their fallacies.
Do you, you're a secular Darwinist.
That's fine. That's a fine label.
Okay. Do you believe in good and evil?
No, no, no. They're only ideas. People fool themselves into doing like horrible things.
You don't think Benjamin Netanyahu is more evil than I am?
I definitely think he's extremely like negligent. I mean, I could definitely see if one looks at his history, I wouldn't be surprised if he's probably aware that he's doing a lot of things that are just totally wrong. I wouldn't be surprised because there are people like that. There are Bernie Madoffs, right? There are people who clearly do things that they know are wrong.
Donald Trump said, I don't know if I'm going to heaven. It's not looking very good.
Yeah, no. No, I definitely believe that you are far more concerned about real life and all that. I would definitely, you know, I definitely think he could.
And I don't mean to insert myself into it. That's irrelevant, but I'm right. Just saying.
And Bibi, he said, I know what America is. America is something that can easily be moved in the right direction. So here we are thinking we have a democracy and we control our government. And this great leader, because he really sees himself as the leader of the free world. He thinks, they really think, you see, the Soviets thought that they were improving society. But the Zionists really think that they invented freedom, that they invented capitalism, right? That they invented Western civilization. And that they're now fighting, you know, our battle for us. I mean, they're making so many facts. They do not know who Karl Menger is. They do not understand how society changed over time and this evolutionary thing. They think they literally invented all this stuff. Now, this is very important. So I got a picture here. You can see Jared Kushner, whose son's Donald Trump's son-in-law, and Steve Witkoff, Trump's realtor friend. And it's amazing when you think that these two men are literally running civilization, right? They were tasked with achieving peace between Russia and Ukraine. They were also the early negotiators of the Iran war. They were also the negotiators of the Israeli-Gaza war and the reconstruction of Gaza. And in the case of Jared Kushner, he was also one of the lead architects of Operation Warp Speed. Not that many people are aware of that. Now, how is it that the Zionized Jews get to essentially be so high up in power where they're actually almost running America, right? Now, naive thinkers will say, oh, well, you know, the Jews are just seeking for power and, you know, they're all a bunch of evildoers. But in reality, this is just the inevitable result of the ideology. Anti-Semitism, Theodor Herzl came up with a bad ideology for it. And this ideology fooled the Jews and fooled the West into constantly giving more help, more sympathy for the Jews, more money to fight all of the wars for them, more ways to overcome anti-Semitism via laws, via police states. And America has been Zionized, not as the result of any malice, right? Just like communism. Now, for example, my grandfather named his three sons after Lenin, right?
Oh, okay.
Now,
he was Cuban.
Yeah, Cuban. Right. This is an example of how people fool themselves into a bad ideology. Now, we can say that communism was disastrous, right? But we can't say that Zionism was disastrous, right? Because that is anti-Semitic. But in reality, to me, that's what it is. It was just one big-ass mistake.
Benjamin Netanyahu gets to control the internet a little more, everything will be fixed.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like the Bolshevik Revolution. I mean, so much money is going for Zionist causes. Now, this year, we're probably going to spend over $2 trillion in military spending. The United States has the printing press, is printing all this money, and all this money is going to Palantir because now we need national security. And a lot of this money ends up going, I mean, the entire U.S. national defense budget, what does it go for? The battle of good versus evil. And what defines what the battle of good versus evil is? It's Zionism and its enemies. And now it's just a runaway, you know, disaster. So again, it's important to realize that all these people move up in power as the result of a complex ideology and not a conspiracy. Now, very important here. Now we get to Milei. So Hayek has an incredible quote. Nobody can be a great economist who is only an economist. And I am even tempted to add that the economist who is only an economist is likely to become a nuisance, if not a positive danger, right? So here we have Milei, who gave a speech in June 11th. And Milei gave the speech and he said, it is important to understand that we are engaged in an existential and moral battle between good and evil. Do you prefer life or death? Good or evil? On one side, there is the barbaric terrorism that kills and destroys, that lies and distorts the truth. On the other side, there is a nation fighting for its right to exist, the sole bastion in the region where freedom and democracy prevail. Keep in mind that by the time he said that, they already passed their laws, making it so you couldn't doubt the October 7th massacre, and they've had Holocaust denial laws, you know, like forever. So Milei is making some two monumental errors. Number one, think about, we just spent an hour talking about the immense complexities of this chaos. And this man wants to reduce it to just good versus evil, and the Zionists are the good, and therefore it's okay. 2 days later, after giving this moral boosting talk, 2 days later is when Iran, when the Israelis bombed Iran. And I can guarantee you that Milei, making it seem like they're the moral leaders and it's okay for them to bomb whoever they want, played a major factor in this. So that is one mistake that Milei is doing. The second mistake is acting. Huh?
I said that's a big one.
That's a big one. Yeah. The second mistake is acting as though he is the carrier of Austrian economics and freedom and free markets. Little does Milei know that Friedrich Hayek and Murray Rothbard knew that the Israeli state was a total calamity. And Rothbard was a Holocaust denier, right? But Hayek too, and this is what Hayek wrote. Hayek wrote in the 1980s, Hayek said the following, quote, "Israel could make no greater contribution to the safety of its own future and to the peace of the world than by offering Jerusalem as the common capital of a Palestine federation." So Hayek really envisioned a totally different Israel. So here is Milei misrepresenting the leading Austrians. The leading Austrians were highly critical of the Zionist disaster. And here he is marrying Israel, you know, with capitalism. That's why the Israelis, that's why we're overthrowing Cuba militarily. We're overthrowing Venezuela and all of these things. I mean, I am totally for capitalism, but we need a capitalism free of the Zionist fallacies.
How would our buddy Walter Block dismiss those claims by Hayek and Rothbard? Quickly, wow. I'm sorry. I know that's a big question.
Yeah, that one we can leave that one for another time. I mean, I don't
okay,
know.
Sorry. Now yeah. You say Rothbard's a Holocaust denier.
Yeah.
How many Jews do you think he believes were killed by Hitler?
I mean, who knows? I mean, I think Germar Rudolph estimated maybe like 400,000. You know, died because of the war. You know, I mean, what they did to the Jews was horrible.
Yes.
Let's not forget that what the Nazis
still
did
not
to Jews,
a walk in the park.
Of course, the Nazis wanted to get rid of the Jews. They took them, they put them in concentration camps, and they wanted to ship them east or send them to Madagascar. Let's not forget, I mean, of course we can question the Holocaust, but what the Nazis did to the Jews was horrible on its own. They really did want to get them out. I mean, that's horrible, right? So both the Soviets and the Zionists, they destroyed the very freedom of speech needed to overcome their fallacies. And they allowed the evolution of an entire echo chamber of fallacies to create a totally flawed ideology. We're just seeing repeats of the same stuff. Now, even though I'm criticizing Milei here, maybe Milei can be a Zionist Gorbachev. Maybe he can wake up and read Murray Rothbard and read Hayek and realize, wait a minute, things are not so simple.
I think that's going to help Argentina if he does that.
Oh, yeah.
I hate to admit it, but let's be real.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're done here. So, I mean, the patterns just keep repeating, obviously, with Netanyahu and Trump as the new Churchill and Roosevelt in some quixotic battle of good versus evil, you know, summarized by the dangerous Zionist U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham. You know, on March 3rd, he said, "Bibi and President Trump are Roosevelt and Churchill, two great wartime leaders together working to bring down evil." You know? So, I mean, I'm showing off here this picture that I took with Karl Menger's grave in Vienna, which I can no longer visit. Right? If I go to Vienna, having doubted the Holocaust, maybe I'll go to jail. Right? So burning witches, World War I, World War II, killing people who don't want to go along with the experts, socialism, killing people who disagree with Andrzej Wyszynski, you know, killing people who believe Zionism was a bad idea. You know, it's all understandable result of economically ignorant, smarter apes that are, you know, unfamiliar with freedom and the competition of ideas. Again, it's very important to realize that this is not the result of malice or stupidity or conspiracy. It is, per Menger, the unintended results of historical development.
Jeez. You said you were going to circle back to David Irving. I didn't hear that.
Oh, you know, I realized I had a longer version of the little talk. Yeah,
that's okay. I know. I've asked you to condense all of this, so yeah, I appreciate that. So that's okay. But do you think David Irving falls for a bunch of anti-Semitic fallacies?
I don't think so. I mean, David Irving is a bit of a racist. You know, they caught him on video one time singing a song like, "I don't want my baby playing with black people," you know, or something like that. But again, what happens is that the way the mob works, if you're a Holocaust denier or revisionist, or you're very critical of Zionism, you can find one mistake that somebody does. Maybe they're a little racist or something like that. And then the mob can just label you that way.
Sure.
And that's what happened, you know, to like David Irving, I think. You know, they branded him as something and so on.
And, okay.
Now here, this is, can you take a quick guess as to what this is?
It looks like something around 1945.
Yeah, I mean, these are Germans. This is the Auschwitz staff. Mm. This is the staff of Auschwitz. And Auschwitz, according to, and not only that, I forgot to mention, there were thousands of pages of medical records in Auschwitz. They had hospitals. The Germans left records showing that they were planning on spending millions of Deutschmarks taking care of people, which you would never find if you were just executing people. Now, because of the Holocaust nonsense, we're supposed to believe that these people who are just taking care of a war camp, of course, it is awful. It's a war camp. You're there against your will and you got to work, right? It's awful. But these people are just people managing this. And we're supposed to believe that this, you know, these people are just out there throwing babies, you know, into gas chambers. Mm. Right? You know, you look at the Discovery Channel and the Hitler documentaries are always about, oh, how nice people can certainly become monsters because look what they did. It has destroyed our ability to reason.
How many people have you interviewed, Jorge, who have done time in jail for questioning the Holocaust narrative?
Just Germar.
Just the one?
Yeah, just Germar. But I have interviewed a few other revisionists. Fred Leuchter was a very important person. He was the first person to do chemical analysis, you know, as part of a trial.
He avoided those countries after he started doing that.
Yeah, he was here in the United States. So I don't think he was.
So you should not go to any of those countries we saw on the chart earlier.
Yeah. Now, who knows what's going to happen. But I just hope that with reason, we can present this properly and really fight for freedom of speech because, you know, it's coming.
Good stuff. Jorge Besada, I always appreciate having you on the show. Before we wrap things up, you already gave your commercial, but how can people learn more about you?
Yeah, thanks. So Besada.com, just follow me on X. I'd appreciate that, at Hayekian. Also, check out my articles at the Mises Institute. I think they're good economics articles. And also, find me at Ron Unz. Ron Unz publishes a lot of stuff. He's one of the few people who really publishes even Holocaust revisionism. And I've written a lot of articles regarding Holocaust revisionism there as well. And so, yeah, thanks.
Good stuff. Well, I appreciate everyone tuning in to the Kelly Patrick Show. Of course, we will have another show out soon. Thank you very much.